Welcome back to the Planning Ideas That Matter podcast from MIT Department of Urban Studies and Planning. I am Samra Lacko, MCP Class of 2020.
And I'm Tiffany Ferguson, MCP 2018.
Welcome back to the Planning Ideas That Matter podcast. For this episode, we're focusing on corporate social responsibility.
Yeah, and if folks are not terribly familiar with the term, or maybe you're highly suspicious of it, what we really wanted to get at with this topic is how the pandemic shaped employer behavior.
With respect to work, workers in the economy, we saw new phenomena emerge like the Great Resignation, record-breaking corporate profits, and historical levels of inflation.
There was a lot of talk in the world, especially early in the pandemic, about a new category of work that we had never, ever talked about before. And that was, as you all, I'm sure, are familiar by now, essential work and essential workers. And this sort of reinvigorated focus on health and safety for frontline workers was also something that we had not talked about since the mid-20th century. So Samra and I had a really great, provocative conversation with two guests who approach the topics of work, the economy, and workers through the lens of the COVID-19 pandemic through really interesting lenses.
Our first guest is Assistant Professor Jason Jackson.
I'm Jason Jackson. I'm an Assistant Professor of Political Economy and Urban Planning and SPIT MIT. I'm really interested in issues of really the institutions that constitute modern capitalism, I suppose, is the broadest way to describe my interests. The kinds of rules, policies, laws, as well as organizations that constitute the structures of global capitalism, in particular thinking about the kinds of distributional effects they have at different levels. So I'm very much a development person, so I'm really interested in how capitalism is organized in ways that, you know, enable and constrain development opportunities for countries in what we call today the global south. I'm also interested in the other dimensions of thinking about distribution, for example, how capitalism distributes resources between capital and labor, between owners of capital and workers at different levels in different countries and different sectors and industries and so forth.
So Tiffany, how would you summarize Jason's interests? This isn't a test, by the way, but it kind of is.
Well, the first thing I should say is Jason was my thesis advisor. So if I failed, then I would look really bad. So I don't really appreciate this setup. But what I do know that I took away from that is Jason's just generally really interested in how macroeconomic structures and policies drive development and inequality, but really at the local level. Eek. How'd I do, Jason, if you're listening? I hope I passed the test.
So what you're saying is he kind of like sees the matrix? I don't know. Anyway, I'd give that a B+, just because A's are overrated. Here's Jason on some points he's currently working on.
I am really interested in questions of economic nationalism. Those tie in with my interest in development, I suppose, most broadly, because I really focus on post-colonial and anti-colonial strands of economic nationalism. But as we all know, economic nationalism is, you know, can no longer be something that's consigned to sort of development into the past, as we've seen, you know, with the kinds of populist nationalism that we are experiencing still, you know, all around the world, from the US to the Philippines to Hungary, Brazil, etc. So that's one big area of my work. And then the other area is really around centering in on questions of technology platforms, in particular platforms in the mobility space. But really, I'm kind of interested in how current platforms as a kind of organizational form, as a way to sort of organize economic activity using particular kinds of digital technologies, both software and hardware, so smartphones and algorithms, basically, how these are constituting a kind of new mode of, or new set of ways in which capitalism works, I guess, to link back to my original point.
Okay, so I remember at DESPS not totally understanding the relationship between political economy and mobility. I understand how mobility and movement in cities is politicized, but Jason's asking some meta questions that I really find interesting. How we move, who transports us, says a lot about our values as a society.
Yeah, and I've actually never thought about how platform companies have become major political and economic actors in cities. There has been a lot of discussion in my field about the astronomical rise of 1099 work, and particularly the roles that companies play in driving that. But taking that a step further, as Jason does, and examines how those companies or institutional actors are reorganizing economic activity in places, I think is super important to understanding Jason's work in general, that I find actually very interesting.
This is a perfect bridge to Jason's reflections on how the pandemic has impacted his work. He starts from a very practical place that I think is worth highlighting. He keeps it real about how the pandemic threw a big monkey wrench into his research process.
I tend to try to spend time in the places where I'm doing research. For the most part, those tend to be outside of the United States. And that's obviously been impossible. So I've taken one flight in the last, this is like not uncommon for most people, right? So I've taken one flight in the last 2 years, maybe, which is crazy compared to what I'd been doing before, doing regular trips to different places and so on. So that's been a big change. And that's kind of forced me, as I'm sure it has others, to kind of rethink the way that I work. And so that's kind of an ongoing thing. I mean, things like Zoom help, but obviously that's a really big challenge in terms of not being able to just see and experience, even if for a relatively short period of time, how the kinds of transformations that I'm most interested in are playing out in different places. Sometimes just being in a, you know, in a city or a country, even if it's only for a few days, you know, you can walk around the street and just kind of get a feel for things. It's actually, I find, can be really, really helpful in getting a sense of just what the kind of atmosphere is, and whether it be, you know, sort of looking at questions of work or other questions, just how people are kind of experiencing those just from being around. And that's something that can't be replicated digitally. But much more importantly, I think, is the question of how we should think about some of the impacts of the pandemic through the lens, for example, of work.
I so appreciate Jason starting from that very human place, like the ways we teach, connect, and even study places and spaces was blown up because of the pandemic. And even our ability to observe, to collect data, to connect with people, to really soak up the stories and the vibe of real places was definitely interrupted.
Yeah, he kept it real, and it was really refreshing to hear, honestly. I think we take for granted a lot of times how information and, quote, facts are created. It goes without saying that the pandemic has transformed how many of us do our work, especially when it comes to going remote. But what has the pandemic taught us about the kind of work that can't be done remotely? Here's Jason discussing why the new category of essential work is a powerful analytical tool.
This new category of essential worker has become almost ubiquitous in our discourse, you know, over the course of the last 2 years. You know, on one hand, this is sort of the extent to which we think and talk about this and sort of categorize some workers under this banner of essential. It's probably good in some ways because it serves to recognize the importance of, as well as unique challenges that workers in a range of places that oftentimes are kind of overlooked experience. This could be everything from, you know, grocery store clerks, delivery people, workers in places that people just don't think about or didn't really think about ever at all before, you know, meatpacking facilities, right? The list goes on, you know, and then of course, people in the healthcare space, which also have just all the category of frontline worker. But essential worker, I think, is interesting because it really allows us to kind of think about analytically workers who otherwise tend to just be kind of overlooked and forgotten and sort of like shrouded when we otherwise think about how the labor market works and really how our society works. I mean, that's the big thing. That's why we've sort of seen them as essential. And then, so recognizing these workers is one thing which has really been important, but the key thing is, you know, then recognizing also the various vulnerabilities they face, certainly to the pandemic, but also the fact that the work that many do tended to be relatively poorly compensated, so relatively low wage, low status, which I think also, unfortunately, matters in terms of outcomes. And so it points to one of the needs that we need to really think about, which is how to address these kinds of inequalities. The markers of inequality are becoming even more stark. So the easiest example to give is like, have a look at the stock market since maybe June 2020. In the middle of a pandemic that has all these economic impacts that we tend to think about as negative, the returns to firms, if we take the stock market as one, probably noisy, but nevertheless one measure of firm profitability, like how well firms are doing, most firms seem to be doing pretty well.
The stark inequality we saw in America is mirrored on the global stage as well in terms of vaccine and healthcare access. This is such a confusing moment in time, at least for me, in that we're seeing such huge gains in firms. We're seeing, you know, the rich get richer, but we're also seeing inflation and seeing the quality and stock of jobs available decline.
What's interesting about this in comparative terms is that the roots of this debate really stem from the way in which the social contract in the United States is organized. Very basically, from around the sort of early mid-20th century, the emerging social contract in the US was that the states, the federal government, would create a sort of conducive business environment for firms to do well. And in turn, firms would provide good jobs for workers. So good jobs meaning wages that allowed for there's a huge gender component here. So wages that would allow for a worker to support a four-person family. So this is very much a kind of heteronormative, you know, husband, wife, two kids, middle class sort of imagination. So a sort of wage that would allow a single worker, presumably the man in the relationship, to earn enough to support this four-person family. And also wages that would rise with productivity. So that is, you know, as companies continue to do better, that the gains from those improvements would be equitably shared between capital, the owners of the business, which could be like a single owner, or as of course in American capitalism, especially with bigger businesses, shareholders. Gains would be shared equitably between owners of capital and labor.
We know that this sharing of gains between firms and workers changed at some point in the 20th century. According to Jason, we see this change beginning to take root as early as the 1970s, which is when this social contract that he talks about begins to break down and economic inequality starts looking really different in America than it does in the rest of the world.
So come back to ride-hailing. Ride-hailing is interesting because it brings this debate really to the forefront in a kind of new sector that relies on new technologies and kind of like new logics of organization. And so that's interesting. So that allows for kind of, you know, we have historicizing inequality and work and gender and race and cities and a whole number of things in the US. But it also allows for comparison because that social contract, that kind of idea that, you know, government will create a kind of conducive environment and firms will make stuff and make money and sort of share the gains with their workers is very much an American thing. In other country contexts, you see different kinds of social arrangements and different kinds of social contracts. In much of Europe, for example, especially Northern Europe, the social contract is different. The state plays much more of a role in delivering social welfare services than do firms in the US. So part of the idea in the kind of sharing of wages in the US context was that it would also be the conduit for providing a number of forms of social welfare. So healthcare, obviously, is the big one in the US. Retirement benefits are another big one, and so forth. So less of these would be provided directly by the state, and many will be provided through the employment relationships. This is why the employment relationship is so central to understanding sort of how welfare writ large, social welfare, is organized in the US. So in many parts of Europe, this is different, especially in Northern Europe, Scandinavian countries, Germany, maybe France to a lesser extent. The state plays much more of a central role. So that we kind of know. But it also is interesting to think about what about the rest of the world, right? So okay, US is one country, Europe is a few dozen countries, but there are 200 and, you know, whatever, like 30-something countries in the world, right? So what about the rest? In the developing world, you see much more variation in the kinds of arrangements through which welfare is provided. The state tends to play a much more central role. Historically, this goes back in many cases to the way in which societies are organized under colonialism. So the colonial structures are very important to sort of think about, and legacies of colonial structures of work relationships, relationships between the state and business, between the state and its citizenry, and between firms and their workers. And the second thing that's really important to consider is structural adjustment. Structural adjustment was one part of a broader shift, which we might call neoliberalism. So neoliberalism is a set of ideas about new ways of organizing the economy where the market and market logics would dominate. So we should organize as much as possible through the market is the sort of idea, because it will generate sort of more efficient outcomes. That's a very brief way maybe of describing what one might mean by neoliberalism. So if we think about the way in which social welfare works and what the kind of relationship is between business, the state, and people in the developing world, then it allows us to think about colonial legacies loves to think about the rise of neoliberalism, about structural adjustments, these kinds of big shifts that took place in the 70s, 80s, and 1990s. And then how those matter in, you know, the 20s that we're in now, when a kind of new technology, which is ride hailing and platforms, emerges.
So Jason has given us a lot of history, a lot of context and theoretical grounding that helps us understand two confounding outcomes we've seen as a result of the pandemic's effect on the economy. The first is that many large, powerful businesses and institutions have won really, really big. They've made record profits at a time when many working people who were already vulnerable and historically far less economically secure have shouldered the worst impacts. These outcomes are decades in the making, and they go back almost 50 plus years.
Jason has set us up perfectly. We've looked back 50 plus years. We heard about the pandemic's macro effects on how we think about workers in the chaotic economic environment we've been in. Our second guest this episode, Carolyn Yang, is on the policy / advocacy side of this work, dealing directly with large tech firms in the Bay Area who are reshaping the landscape of jobs, wages, housing, and the actual form of the city itself.
My name is Carolyn Yang. I hail from the Bay Area in California originally. I graduated in DESP in 2020 with a focus on housing, community, and economic development. I'm really, really fortunate to work for a small but mighty nonprofit called Tech Equity Collaborative. And so the mission of our nonprofit organization is to mobilize tech workers and tech companies to advance housing and labor and workforce equity where tech companies are based. And I'm the corporate partnership manager, which means that I get to wrangle tech companies into thinking about how their products can have a better impact on the communities that they work with.
Okay, so before we jump into the pandemic and what Carolyn is seeing in the field as a result, because she is an alum, we have to know how she ended up in planning school.
It was totally unexpected, totally unplanned. So I studied international relations and public policy in undergrad, and then I was just a tech worker in San Francisco. So I worked for an advertising technology company. And I just experienced so many levels and layers of moral and cognitive dissonance living in San Francisco. I was like, okay, well, income inequality is at its most extreme. I am like on a street level experiencing human suffering, right? Like unsheltered folks seeing rampant wealth and rampant wealth generation opportunities in sort of all of these quote unquote unicorn companies going public and, you know, a newly minted class of gazillionaires popping up all over the city and their influence on the city, the types of services that they're seeking out, fancy laundry services, really high-end restaurants, moving more into demanding experiences, like paying a lot of money for like VR experiences and whatever, and saying like, this isn't the San Francisco I knew and grew up visiting. I was like, okay, well, it's probably time to go back to city planning school because I really want to understand urban development, job creation, and sort of like trade-offs at a city level. And by trade-offs, I mean trade-offs between what I imagined to be social, racial, and economic equity versus economic growth.
My head is spinning at how much Carolyn is describing the real-world version of Jason's macroeconomic trends. Like, this is what it looks like in a place where firms are accruing all these gains and distributing them so narrowly to their own workers. The massive profits from these companies go to abstract places like investors. But what I like about planning is that it provides a real-world picture of how these abstract forces actually play out in real life, in real places where real people live and call home. I, because I'm nerdy like this, actually really love when theory and practice come together like this.
It's so true that for many of us, we find our way to planning school because of our lived experience of inequality or failed attempts at understanding why the world around us is designed the way it is. I also learned now that I've graduated from planning school, you don't really get the answers for how to change those things. Sometimes it can be a little bit frustrating that we can't just make it all right, but understanding the theory, history, and context for the status quo is definitely important in the work of generating ideas for change.
I went to planning school and I sought out DUSP specifically because I was really interested in understanding how tech companies can have a more responsible social and economic footprint. And what that means is, okay, well, if mayors and governors and even our president, whoever it may be at a given time, like if we're seeking out innovative growth, right? If we're doling out tax incentives to attract tech companies and they promise job creation on a local level, they say, we'll create 10,000 jobs. In fact, we'll fund, you know, this many units of affordable housing. Yeah, I went to planning school trying to understand, okay, what's at stake here, right? Like, for whom is this economic growth planned for, right? And what does equity mean? What does inclusion mean? And to this day, that's still a question I have. Like, what does it mean to be a tech hub? What is an innovation economy?
So we learned in our chat with Carolyn that her focus at work was originally related to affordable housing development as a countermeasure to luxury housing development and displacement. We asked Carolyn to share what, if any, impact the pandemic had on her work.
There's fewer luxury projects that are popping up both in the commercial and residential space. And so I've really been able to shift my focus into thinking about tech companies, entrepreneurs, and founders who are chasing after this new trend of automating age-old, very manual housing processes. So screening a tenant, finding an apartment to rent, getting pre-approved for a mortgage, getting an appraisal. Many of these housing processes, paperwork, heavy, manual, like, you know, you have to go into an office to kind of do these things. Like, getting a mortgage approved in 1 minute is, right, like what a lot of these companies are promising online. And yeah, I started getting really interested. I'm like, okay, well, if these companies are getting hundreds of millions of dollars of funding and going after hundreds of thousands of new users, like first-time homeowners, tenants, like how is a history of housing discrimination going to affect the product impact and who these companies are targeting, why they're targeting, what the fine print is, right, in doling out a mortgage, handing out a loan. And yeah, what are the equity implications? Specifically, you know, what do these companies mean by offering inclusive, transparent, accessible solutions?
What I'm picking up on here is an expanded way of thinking about corporate responsibility. I don't know about you, Samra, but like at first I felt like this was a conversation about how you, big company, big developers, how do we make sure you build a little something for the little people while you're out there building all these units for high-income folks? Now what I hear Carolyn sort of alluding to is a shift in the narrative, which is, hey, you big company, big developer, big financial institution, how are you building financial products that actually provide access to home ownership for the quote-unquote little people? Personally, I see that kind of more upstream thinking taking root in the corporate responsibility space. And Carolyn had a whole lot to say about the rise of this more social outcomes-focused thinking in the private sector.
The most interesting part of what I'm doing now is this sort of like corporate activism piece. I think we're beyond the days of diversity and inclusion. I think we're moving past ESG. So that's environmental, social, and governance concerns. And we're really moving into the space of corporate activism. And so I think a lot of companies, in light of George Floyd's murder, in light of the pandemic and the inequality that has been worsening, a lot of companies have come out to make these very public statements about their dedication to equity, to inclusion. Some companies have even taken it further in saying, okay, we are going to shift our product and we are going to shift our workplace practices and workforce hiring practices to address a lot of these social concerns that we care about, right? So I think many companies that I'm lucky to work with actually have come to us saying, what more can we do? We don't just want this to be some kind of PR move. We really want to shape our product. We really want to think about hiring folks from non-traditional backgrounds, right? Folks returning from incarceration. We really want to think about bringing in first-time homeowners of color and really ensuring that they're able to have the tools to build wealth over time. But what can we do? Where do we start? We don't know how to start, right? And so I think part of what Tech Equity does is offer that sort of strategic support. We introduce tech companies to friendly partner organizations that we vetted. And it's a combination of brainstorming, setting goals, understanding what success metrics look like, and specifically what a given company means by, oh, we want to do something equitable, or we want to engage in inclusive hiring. That means, okay, setting up a pipeline of hiring 10 candidates from non-traditional backgrounds. Non-traditional backgrounds mean, you know, XYZ, or you can say, like, we're working with this organization to hire 10 folks returning from incarceration. We're redesigning how a hiring manager and even a talent team person thinks about recruiting, hiring, and long-term retention, long-term career growth opportunities for this individual, for folks that are being hired. So yeah, it's really about getting into the nitty-gritty and the specifics of corporate activism that really gets me up and going every morning, because I think it is a new angle. And I think for the companies that are really eager to do something and really marshal up resources and commitments, it's an interesting opportunity.
I'm glad Carolyn got into some nitty-gritty specifics here, because I'm an engineer by training, so I like to get down to practical, measurable steps sooner rather than later. If I'm being honest, this topic is hard for me to understand. Are we waiting for companies to be nice, to act charitably, to hire a few people from the community, and then what? Are we done? We've got equity and justice and inclusive cities? I wasn't entirely clear on how a private actor could do this work, so I probed a bit more with Carolyn to better understand how companies institutionalize this kind of social impact strategy. Here's her very helpful breakdown of external and internal private sector social impact strategies.
I would organize it across two sort of major buckets. I would say there are internal initiatives versus external initiatives, and I'll start with internal. So as a company, there are a lot of internal functions that you might care about when you think about social impact. You want to make sure that your own recruiting, hiring, and retention practices are sound, that they offer families the same pay, that workers have a voice, that everyone is treated well and doing well at work. Internally, you also have initiatives or programs, right? And this can range from having an employee resource group all the way to having a team of folks that sit across, you know, the organization that are coming together and saying, okay, like, what are some concerns that people might have about our products? Or like, what are some risks that we need to mitigate, right? So there's groups like that as well. Whereas externally, a company might say, okay, how does the rubber hit the road? Like, how does our product or how does our service come up against local legislation? What do we care about? What are concerns? Or in the worst case scenario, what are the lawsuits that are coming up when it comes to our product, our services, our presence in a place or in a country? How is that affecting local communities? And I think the internal program support, program building piece is an entry point, and also the external kind of setting out a policy agenda, convening roundtables to really workshop in a closed room product and service impact with a group of industry leaders and even like community stakeholders, local government stakeholders. You know, that's more of an external approach. And this internal, external designation might seem like a very sort of academic exercise, but I think community organizations and advocacy groups should really have both an internal strategy and an external strategy as they're sort of thinking about how companies can be more responsible in engaging in inclusive planning.
That was super helpful context for me and hopefully others who aren't as familiar with this space. We haven't mentioned this much, but Tiffany, this is kind of your space. This is your bread and butter. And part of your current job is actually developing and driving your organization's DEIB strategy and program. I didn't know there was a B in DE&I.
Yeah, there is a B now. It's for belonging. And the way I think of it is, if you're doing the other three right, belonging is what you have. And so the short of it is, belonging is about making sure your workplace is a place where everyone can feel like they belong there. They don't feel like an outsider. They don't feel like there aren't people who have their back. They don't feel like their points of view are marginal. It's sort of like, to me, the culmination of doing the work in all the other places. But yeah, to Carolyn's sort of description, I thought it was a really great, helpful, concise nugget about the internal-external approach. And there's one visual out there, if anyone's interested, that I'd highly recommend. And it's from the Center for Global Inclusion's Standards for Organizations Around the World, la la la. If you Google GDEIB, it'll pop right up. And what it is a handy visual of a triangle of the components of an organizational DEIB strategy. And I think it breaks it down into just enough detail to sort of better understand what the potential levers are for corporate activism and, frankly, employment activism in general for any employer, not just of the private sector variety. That's my two cents.
I will check it out. You guys should all check it out as well. The last part of this conversation with Carolyn is really us asking my favorite question for all the speakers. What are you excited about right now? What's giving you energy in this tough time?
Yeah, there are a lot of things I'm really excited about. I'm really excited about workers finding their voice and saying, no, I quit. I quit. This is ridiculous. I'm really excited about, you know, movements to build tenant power in light of this like wave of evictions that we're facing, right? As these eviction moratoriums end. I'm really excited about what we do with our public space. Like all of these parklets popping up, all of these street closures are hopefully here to stay. I'm really excited about the fact that tech companies and local governments are really forced to see the fact that housing and work and the future of work and preparing for automation in a very personal way, in a very like local and community oriented way, that is like the future of work and that is important. And I think people are being forced to define what they mean by equity and inclusion. And I've never seen that before. I think we can be really specific about what it is we're advocating for. And that's when, you know, new ideas and solutions and different types of people can come together. And yeah, so I'm really excited to think big and use our imagination because there's some real constraints that we're facing here, like financially, socially, health-wise. So we have to be creative now.
What a ride. There's a lot that I took from this that I wasn't really sure where this conversation was going to go, honestly.
Yes. Never know where it's going to go, but definitely another pair of enraging, thoughtful, provocative, and inspiring conversations. I don't think this would be planning if you didn't feel a little rage and optimism in the same moment, you know? That's just me. But let's jump into our recap. Samra, why don't you go first? The question here is, what are you sitting with? What are you taking away from this conversation about corporate social responsibility in the economy during a time of massive disruption, aka the COVID-19 pandemic?
I have a lot of feelings when we talk about the subject of corporate social responsibility and political economy and DEIB. And I'm really excited that the measurements of change, like the fact that DEI and DEIB are becoming so mainstream. I'm excited that corporate social responsibility or corporate social activism is on the rise and that companies are paying attention. I'm really happy that people like Jason and Carolyn are dedicating themselves to making change and documenting what's happening. I think in the case of Jason, I said earlier that he sees the matrix, but he really is sort of like making real and studying things that we kind of feel intrinsically, like we're all working in this economy, in this environment, in this climate. And so there's a lot of stuff that common experiences that are hard to measure and are hard to define. And I think that Jason has the very difficult task of making sense out of that. And for Carolyn, on the other hand, she's appealing to the most powerful companies in America and in the world on behalf of like everyday people. So it's just a lot to take in, I think. And it's hard to look at it in a distanced way, again, because we're all working, we all have feelings about the economy. Where I get stopped is that, you know, we're seeing company towns pop up. We're seeing, you know, something that is so cyclical, right? Because we used to have that those during the Industrial Revolution, and then there was like a workers' revolution, then we had unions, and the company town kind of sort of faded away. And so now that that's coming back, it feels a little ominous. It just feels like almost like there's the branding part of corporate social responsibility, and then there's the actuality of what makes profits for shareholders, and they're often at odds. And I think that policy-wise, because these companies contribute so much to the economy in terms of like gains, and that their workers pay taxes, and that they can lobby the government, and then also that they contribute to GDP, means that they're not going to be regulated in the way that they should be. So I think I'll leave it at that and just quickly get on my soapbox for anybody here who works in economics or works with economists, that GDP is a totally inappropriate measurement of equality or like the status of an economy in a country, because it's an average, and often it's used to justify some not so great things.
These are some big topics. I'm glad to know smart people, passionate people, people I feel are aligned with my values, who are working on these issues, studying them, and doing so across the table with these private companies. Like, that's what I hear. And they're also not the only ones doing this work. You know, there's many people in other fields of study, at other schools, and in other practice areas, which I learned from my time doing the sustainability certificate at the Sloan School of Management, MIT's business school. And what I found over there is there is a lot of conversation about ESG and CSR, about making it real, about making it measurable, making it material to stakeholders and consumers, corporate employees, and even government regulators.
It's really great that these things are actually coming out from our conversations, and that like urban studies as a field is a place to sort of like hone in and think critically about this. What I would love to see is more planners in positions of power. Yeah, like you're working on the national scale, and like until there's like some huge overhaul of the logic of our economy, the work that Carolyn's doing is very important, because you can't get caught up in the big picture when there's actual need that's urgent and immediate. And you can do something about that, even if it's on a smaller scale than national policy.
Yes, absolutely. So a lot to think about, but definitely feeling like we covered a lot of ground related to what the pandemic has revealed about sort of how corporate actors are functioning in society, how workers are relating to that, what's been happening in the economy. Excited to see what we talk about next.
So we'll see you guys next time on Planning Ideas That Matter.
Thanks to today's guests,
Jason Jackson and Carolyn Yang.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Planning Ideas That Matter podcast, a production by the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Our theme song was composed and recorded by the DUSP alumna band, Eminent Domain. Other music in this season is by Blue Dot Sessions. This season is made possible through the generosity of the Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at MIT in the form of BEMIS funding, and through the support of the DUSP headquarters faculty and staff. Thank you. And we would like to extend a special thank you to all of our faculty and alumna guest speakers for their time and reflections. Until next time.